This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 10th of March 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, John Everard and Raffaello Pantucci will tell us, amongst other things, why a 100% turnout and 100% yes vote doesn't necessarily tell the whole story of elections in North Korea. And
what's your assessment of relationships between Beijing and Moscow? Is the US justified in being suspicious of Sino-Russian ties, which it believes are aimed at countering its pivot to Asia policy?
We'll also ask whether a Sino-Russian bloc could grow out of the Ukraine crisis. Plus, the man behind the legendary Montreal Jazz Festival tells us about his inspiration.
We don't see jazz festival as a piece of museology. We try and be as contemporary as can be, and try to take into account all the different musical styles that have touched jazz or that jazz has touched.
All that plus a guided tour of Rio's celebrated Ma Museum by our correspondent in the city. That and more all lies ahead in the next 60 minutes, right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to look forward to then in the next hour here on the programme, but before we begin, let's hear from Jonathan Wheatley, who's here with the latest world news.
Interpol has confirmed that two passengers on the Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777, which went missing on Saturday, used stolen Austrian and Italian passports, raising suspicions of foul play. 239 people were on board the aircraft, which was flying from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, when it disappeared from radar screens. Accident investigators suspect the plane may have disintegrated in mid-flight. Well, Abhalruddin Abdul Rahman, Director General of Malaysia's Department of Civil Aviation, said they were perplexed as to how it happened.
The Honourable Prime Minister used the word perplexing. We are equally puzzled as well. To be confirmed what really happened on that particular day on this ill-fated aircraft, we need concrete evidence. We need parts of the aircraft. It's unprecedented missing aircraft mystery, as you can put it. It is mystified, and we are increasing our efforts to do what we have to do.
Well, several countries have joined the search operation, including Australia and New Zealand, who both had nationals on that flight. The Australian Prime Minister is Tony Abbott.
This is a terrible tragedy. There are lots and lots of questions that people have. At the moment, we don't have answers, but it's important that we are out there looking, and that's a search which is now being materially assisted by the Royal Australian Air Force.
Other news now, and the so-called Blade Runner Oscar Pistorius broke down today when a South African court heard details from the autopsy of girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp, whom the track star is accused of murdering on Valentine's Day last year. The testimony of pathologist Gert Seyman was interrupted twice by Pistorius's sobbing and retching. An estimated 50,000 ultra-Orthodox Jews held a mass prayer in New York's financial district to protest against a bill that would cut their Israeli community military exemptions. The organizers, an alliance of different American Jews, called on people to attend the protest against new legislation ending the wholesale army exemptions granted to seminary students, which is expected to pass in the coming weeks. Yosef Rapaport, one of the organizers, estimated that around 50,000 people were present at that prayer meeting.
And the only thing that sustained us all through the years is the study of our religion. And so we feel that the government of Israel, as it is instituted right now, is threatening that and trying to curb the growth of Torah study. And we are very upset about that.
Lawyers for three college friends of the accused Boston Marathon bomber, who are charged with helping cover up evidence of the crime on Monday, asked for more records related to their arrests. A large number of police swarmed the apartment south of Boston, shared by two of the men, both Kazakh exchange students, during a massive manhunt on the 19th of April for the bombing suspect, Johar Sanayev. And finally, staying in the United States, we end this news with a very gruesome story. For 6 years, the bills were paid, the grass was cut, and no one noticed the body of a dead woman sitting in the back seat of a car of a residential Pontiac in a garage in a neighborhood of Michigan. Her mummified body has now been found after someone was dispatched to check on the property that fell into foreclosure after the money ran out on her account and the mortgage payments, not surprisingly, stopped. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. 5 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. We'll be hearing more news from Jonathan Wheatley at around the bottom of the hour. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House, here with me, Tom Edwards, on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Where you, London? This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 in New York City. A very good afternoon to our listeners on the Eastern Seaboard. Well, joining me now here in London with their take on today's news stories are two Monocle regulars, dare I say stalwarts of Monocle 24. That's them chuckling there. John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, is here, as is Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you,
Thank you.
With us. As always, we start today in North Korea, in what's perhaps the least surprising news of the last couple of days, or perhaps any days. Kim Jong-un has received the absolute support of his people. That was in quotation marks, in Sunday's parliamentary election. State media report 100% of, just under 100% of eligible North Koreans voted, and 100% of votes cast were in favour of the status quo. Voting's mandatory, there's only one option. But if these elections are a farce, why are they held every 5 years in the country? I'll come to you, John, first of all. Why not? It's your area of expertise. What is the point of these? Is it just a sort of continuing propaganda exercise? What lies behind it?
Well, yes. I mean, the way it works is now actually a continuing propaganda exercise. You're quite right. The way it came about is that the North Korea, when it was founded, inherited a Soviet-style constitution. And you will remember that the Soviet Union, not exactly a beacon of liberal democracy, but it did actually hold elections from time to time. And so the same kind of clause was written into the North Korean constitution. This left the North Korean leadership with the question, what do you do about elections in a state which is anything but pluralist? And their answer was to turn it into a great political party. Of course, you know, there's only one name on the ballot paper. It's not quite true you only have one option. You can go to a separate booth and cross the name out. But most people who do that sort of disappear quickly afterwards, and it's generally discouraged. And apparently this time around, nobody throughout the country did it. So you ask your citizens for this great show of loyalty. Everybody expresses their support for the officially approved candidate. And then you get on with the serious business of party making. You go outside, you have kiddies choir singing to you, food circulates, people with a guitar strum happily by the riverbank, and it's all one big party day. The North Koreans love it.
I mean, I guess that's what's really interesting, isn't it, Raffaello, when you look at these things. It's perhaps more interesting who's currying favour? What are the mover and shakers? Can we read anything into the people who appear on the sort of ballot pages? Looking from the West, do you think there are other facets of this that are interesting, or is it simply a kind of intriguing cultural and political exercise that we can regard from outside the borders?
Well, I mean, I suspect, as with most things with North Korea, there's such a sort of level of opacity with the government instructions and what's actually happening there, that any sort of event in which we see senior figures, or we see people, frankly, of a political within a political structure in this country appearing on television, a lot is read into it. Now, I think John clearly would know much better than me how well these tea leaves are being read or not. But my sense is that basically whenever there's an opportunity and we see Kim Jong-il appearing, there's immediately a sort of speculation about, well, he's standing next to him and that person, and so on. It's a bit of a sort of Kremlinology, which you see from back in the day. And, you know, I suspect some of it's accurate. I suspect some of it's not. I have no real sense of that necessarily. But I think that, you know, as with a lot of these sort of authoritarian regimes, they do like to have a sort of what they what looks like, or they consider, a sort of democratic process. And I think that's part of showing, oh, no, we actually do this. And it shows that we do have this sort of facet of our society covered as well. And we do engage with our people, no matter how sort of, you know, ridiculous the whole process does seem, and how it's much more of a sort of celebration of North Korean sort of, you know, a nice day out, I guess. Spring has landed here. Maybe it started in North Korea as well. I don't know. So I think there's a little bit of that involved in this. But I do suspect that probably, you know, a serious North Korea watchers will read, who, you know, I see a sister of his has apparently appeared in some of the coverage. Mm. I believe this is now then perception. Maybe she's being elevated in the system in some way. I think it's very difficult to know in North Korea there.
Well, that's right. The North Korea watchers will be going through the lists of the Seoul candidates for the constituencies to see who is in, who is out. If you know your way around the North Korean political scene, you can get some kind of feel for which factions are rising, which factions are falling, and so on and so forth. You asked us now whether there's another aspect of this from the Western point of view. There is. I mean, nobody is going to claim that these elections are anything to do with democracy. But should North Korea ever change, and you know, we live in hopes it might, as we saw when the Soviet Union fell, having an electoral machinery is very important. It means that you have got established polling stations, established voter lists, and generally the mechanism for elections is all there. And if the day ever comes where you do move towards democracy, although in political terms, the crossover from having just one candidate to having more than one candidate is, of course, of enormous significance. In administrative terms, just in terms of running the election, it's actually very easy to make that change. And it meant that when a lot of the Eastern European countries moved into democracies, that the transition was greatly eased by the fact that electoral machinery was there. The same might happen one day in North Korea. Let's see.
Do you think that's just wishful thinking, though, Raffaello? It's a good point that these logistics could be, you know, laid out before we get to that scenario. But does that remain in your view as distant as ever?
I mean, you know, I think you're 100% right, John, that this is you've created an infrastructure that now exists that can then maybe be turned. But I mean, you know, we thought there was a lot of sense when Kim Jong-un came in that everyone was like, oh, well, maybe he's a reformer because he went to a Swiss school for a while, and somehow this therefore means all this other stuff. That didn't turn out to be the case. Kim Jong-il before it, I seem to recall there was some speculation then. This to me feels like a very resilient regime that does have quite a grip of power here. And so I don't know if we're going to suddenly see it change dramatically at all. But you know, I guess we have to see. But, you know, I think John's 100% right that this does at least put some sort of a structure in place that potentially could be opened up if maybe outside forces applied enough pressure to make them want to change in some way.
And gazing into those tea leaves that Raffaello mentioned earlier, John, he also mentioned Kim Yo-jong, the sister of Kim Jong-un, who's apparently now being slightly more prominent. What can we read anything in the early signs of her increased prominence, perhaps of any other factors? You mentioned these other sort of actors who maybe seasoned watchers can observe and chart their movement. Yeah. Far too early to observe any of those, or do you think there are any little trends that we might be able to see which could have some bearing in the coming sort of months and years, possibly even?
Trends amongst the candidates to these elections, too early to say. We'll have to let the analysts run through these name lists and see what they come up with. Kim Jong-un's younger sister, yes, significant. It's not the first time she's appeared. She's done so several times before. But this is the first time that she's been described as a senior official. Mm. What is happening? The Kim regime is deeply nepotistic. And Kim Jong-un knows that the only people you can really trust are his own family. Now, he's just shot a whole lot of those. So he's a bit short of relatives right now, and it's starting to bring other people in, so his sister gets a job.
And well, I imagine that's rather a thankless task, isn't it? Do come in, welcome them into the fold, given that background. But
well, yes.
Would it be a reluctant recruit, I guess, is what I'm asking you? Or do you think she would be willingly? I mean, how do we know any sense of how the intricacies of that family work, really?
No, we don't. We had some insight into the way that the family worked under Kim Jong-il, because Kim Jong-il's personal sushi chef defected and spilt the beans, or would that be spilt the sushi? So that we know an awful lot about the interpersonal relationship. But what's actually going on in the court of Kim Jong-un and in the great marble palaces of the regime? No, we don't actually know a whole lot.
And it may stay that way for some time, I suspect. Yeah. Let's move on, gentlemen, to another story that's been dominating today's, indeed, the headline since Saturday, the disappearance of flight MH370, en route, of course, from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. The use of stolen passports, as we were hearing confirmed by Interpol on the news, by two passengers on the flight has raised additional security concerns. Interpol estimates passengers were able to board aircraft more than a billion times last year without having their passport screened against an existing and fairly robust database. Raffaello, obviously it's difficult. We don't want to speculate too much whilst there's still so much uncertainty surrounding the fate of this plane and the luckless people on board. But it's hard not to look at screening processes and security within the aviation sector. What have you made just broadly in terms of the news of these two who've travelled, though clearly existing, you know, hundreds of miles away, the actual passport owners? What do you make of it?
I think it's very, very difficult to know. I mean, this whole story, I can understand why people are getting very concerned about it. A plane drops out of the sky, one of the 777s, which is, you know, one of the workhorses of the international aviation industry. There's an understandable sense of concern. Why has this happened? What has this happened? And the fact that you do have these two individuals who seem to have boarded with passports that have been stolen, and they were the tickets for them were purchased by some mysterious person in Tehran who was doing it to... I mean, there's a lot of things you could read into this and come to weigh the conclusion that there are some nefarious acts at play, but we simply don't know is the reality of the situation. We've absolutely no idea. These two passport holders could be a giant red herring, you know, that we're just all sort of focusing on because it is the most obvious sort of line of investigation. But, you know, I think that there are probably multiple lines of investigation that I think the FBI and other agencies are probably looking at, including the Mayor authorities. I think the question about airport security, and in particular Kuala Lumpur airport security, is probably going to be rising up the agenda. And I think how the Malay authorities and the Malaysian Airlines have particularly handled this incident is, I think, raising a few questions and eyebrows. I think at root to the fact that these two passport holders were able to get on board this plane. I think the Malays here got themselves into an awkward situation. But if I understood the head of Interpol's comments correctly, there's a lot of countries out there that don't check the passports that come in against this database. So, you know, we'll be holding the Malays to a different sort of standard here. I don't know. I mean, I've been through that airport a few times and, you know, security wasn't the same as the screening process I went through in Heathrow. That's true. But, you know, that's not to say it wasn't being attentive. But I think the fundamental question is here that we really don't know what's happened to this airplane. And, you know, the reality is it could just be a very freak accident in the same way it could be some sort of terrorist incident from a new group who we've never even heard of before.
That's quite the case. I just wonder, though, John, despite that reticence about speculating, it is interesting that some of these actors of Interpol making these claims about people who are less rigorous than they should be, perhaps not using resources that are there at their disposal. Do you think that betrays a more of a fundamental problem about how certain of these international organisations overlap and work together? I mean, is that something of a broader concern to you outside of the specific details of this incident?
Well, yes. I mean, collaboration between international terrorist organisations has got to be a concern to all of us. We're talking here about the comments by Interpol. I'm intrigued by the comments by the Chinese, who screamed at the Malays and criticised very severely what they regard as the inadequacies of the Malay security screening systems. Clearly, the Chinese clearly believe that everybody else ought to run a nice big police state with lots of people frisking you every inch of the way. Let's just hope that this incident doesn't lead us anywhere down that road. Important, too, that one of the less reported remarks of Interpol, that not all those who carry false passports are terrorists, and not all terrorists carry false passports. I think we also have that in big letters in front of us. It may well be, as you rightly said, that the two guys with false passports are just one big red herring. They may have just some of the passports to be, I don't know, illegal immigrants somewhere, maybe something completely unconnected with the air disaster. And if this was a terrorist incident, we still don't know. It may well be that we find that those who perpetrated it actually use valid passports in their own names. If you're going to die anyway, who cares?
Absolutely. Raffaello, just in terms of that broader point, I mean, John's reflecting there about international organisations working together. What about countries working together? Because it's perhaps unsurprising given the seriousness of this incident. But is it a sign somewhat of what can be achieved if circumstances demand it? We have China, Vietnam, US, the Thais, Australia, Singapore, Indonesia, you know, all working together. Do you take some kind of solace, I guess, from the fact that we can seem to mount a, you know, fairly redoubtable operation involving a lot of countries who, let's be quite clear, haven't necessarily got on that well in recent history?
No, I mean, in a way, that could be the silver lining of this whole incident. The fact that you do have all these countries that, you know, border the South China Sea that have been, frankly, involved in quite, you know, acrimonious disputes over various rocks and islands, a piece of territory. They're actually working together to try to find this this missing airplane. And that's got to be a good thing. And it does establish sort of levels of connectivity and local interaction at a certain level, which is probably beneficial in some way, shape or form. I do think it is interesting, though, and I think John's right to highlight it, this question about the Chinese getting very angry at the Malays in particular. But I think that's about information flows. And I think it's about the Malay government really not keeping everyone up to date about what is actually happening. I saw before that one of their ministers said something about the people, these two mysterious people on these passports, being of Asian appearance. And then I saw just before we came on here that, in fact, this has now been completely discounted. That sort of information, I'm sure, just aggravates the situation. And especially when our understanding is the families in China, while they seem to be being sequestered in some sort of hotel, it's not clear how much they're actually being told, how much they're being kept abreast of this. And I think that's probably what the Chinese government is responding to, this sort of very live public anger. My understanding from friends in Beijing is that there is a real palpable anger in Beijing about what's happened here. You know, we must remember this comes less than a week after the incident in Kunming, where, again, this is about the government, you know, reacting to public displeasure and public anger. And so in this situation, they have an outside actor they can point at quite clearly. And so I think it's not surprising that the government would shout about it in this way.
Well, just briefly on that point, do you detect a real change then in terms of how Beijing is reacting to these sorts of events? Is that a palpable sense of change, or do you think it's natural that they'll respond as circumstances demand it?
I think that the government in Beijing has generally been responding to public anger in an increasing way. And I think that's one of the interesting things you can see when we look at the sort of growth of Weibo and other sort of social media and the sort of Chinese public's use of these things as ways of venting their anger. The way that the Chinese government reacts to that is fascinating. And in some ways, it's not exactly a sort of democratic process because, you know, who's people sitting on these websites who are shouting about these things. But it is a sort of accountability and it is something that the government is having to react to. And I think that's definitely something that we've seen happening increasingly over the past few years.
We'll be talking a little more about China in respect of Ukraine and in respect of the Asian century. When we come back after a short break, we'll be hearing more here on Midori House from both Raffaella Pantucci and from John Everard. Stay tuned.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. Still with me, John Everard and Raffaello Pantucci. Now let's consider, what will the world look like following the Ukraine crisis? The last few weeks, of course, have left Europe with a bit of Cold War aftertaste. But of course, in the 21st century, the broader alliances have changed. 2 days ago, China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi bragged about the Sino-Russian relationship being at its best stage in history. Terrible timing, John. What do you make of that remark?
Not exactly terrible timing. I'd say rather fortuitous, wouldn't you? He made that remark, you're quite right. He also talked about the tasks ahead, including ever deeper cooperation and partnership between China and Russia. Now, this is language the Chinese tend to use in countries they're really cuddling up to. They used to use it, for example, in the case of North Korea. And if I were Russian listening to that and knowing the Chinese background, I think my blood would be running just a little bit cold. The Chinese know that right now the Russians need them a whole lot more than they need the Russians. That Russia is in the process of blowing holes through its relationship with the West, and at a time when the Russian economy is in the doldrums, 1.3% growth last year, even the UK beat that. And Putin needs two things to keep him in power. He needs money, lots of it, and he needs prestige. And at the moment, both are seriously at risk over Ukraine. So one of the long-term effects I see coming out of the Ukraine crisis is to push the Chinese and the Russians closer together. Probably not good news.
Raffaello, what do you make of that? Do you go along with that analysis in the first instance? And should it provide cause for concern as we look on?
Well, I mean, I think that I don't think it should cause too much cause for concern, because I think fundamentally, I think it's something that John was hinting at, is this notion that, in fact, this is not a balanced relationship. This is a fundamentally relationship where the Chinese are the ones who have the upper hand and the ones that's growing. I think the Russian economy is one that's been very reliant on the export of, you know, natural gas and other raw materials, without being a very sort of productive economy in innovation terms, in terms of other things as well. So I think that this is a relationship which is very imbalanced towards China. I mean, China is a growing power which does have growing interests. And it's one where, you know, if we look around the world and we can see, you know, if we look at things like in Syria, for example, or we look at Iran, we can see that it's really the Russians who are the ones who are shouting about supporting. The Chinese just sort of go along with it, and they go along in the slipstream, you know, but they don't need to call attention to themselves. They can do it. The Russians really need to make a point. Ukraine, the same thing, you know. I mean, fundamentally, the Chinese don't really, I think, agree with what the Russians are doing there. You know, this is basically recognizing a separatist, potentially separatist area and letting it break away. You go back and look at Georgia when the Russians started, you know, going to Ossetia and South Ossetia and Abkhazia. You know, that was the Chinese were very against that. The last thing they want is for the world to go around acknowledging, you know, breakaway provinces as, you know, separatist entities that should be allowed to go off and do what they wanted. So I think that there is a sort of fundamental imbalance here and disagreement here. And so I think that, you know, while the Russians and the Chinese, they may tout this relationship as a very close and intimate one, I think that it's one that's very much balanced in Beijing's favor. And certainly when I've spoken to Russian diplomats in Beijing, you do get that sense of concern, that sort of, in some way, the cold blood that John was talking about. They are worried a bit. They realize how the bread is buttered in many ways, but they realize that this is also a relationship which, at the same time, from a sort of global geostrategic level, it's one that has to work very closely together.
Absolutely right. I agree with all of that. As a further rider, Georgia was bad enough, but in the case of Crimea, you have a province which has been allowed, in Russian eyes, to secede by having its own referendum and declaring its own independence. Now, if that ever became accepted as an international principle, how many bits of China start to drop off? I mean, the Chinese, on the one hand, are delighted that this sort of frostiness has appeared, to say, between Russia and the West. On the other hand, there's quite a lot of bad ideas from their point of view coming out of Crimea, all a little worrying.
Now, before I let you go from Studio One here at Midori House, I did want to ask you a little about some economic news. China again and Japan, both countries have released some pretty disappointing economic data. Asian shares have tumbled today, of course. I guess in broad terms, you know, where does this leave us in terms of, you know, the sort of Asian economic domination, the Asian century we were all waiting for? Is it sort of dead in the water, John? What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's not only dead in the water, I think it's starting to smell quite bad as well. I mean, it's noticeable that if you Google the phrase Asian century, the most recent uses of that word in mass media tend to be quite a long time ago. It's one of those ideas that have been quietly buried. Here we are looking at China, which is supposed to be the great growth engine of the 21st century, just posted a stonking great balance of payments deficit. Okay, it was over Chinese New Year, which partly explains it, but even so, it was far, far bigger than anybody thought. Just announced an 18% drop in exports. And its finance minister saying that this 7.5% growth target that has been nailed to the wall, it didn't actually mean 7% as such, just sort of around 7%. It might be just a little bit lower than 7.5%. Who knows? And okay, that's one big Asian power. The Japanese, almost within about 24 hours of the China data coming out, announced, I think, it's a 1.5 trillion yen deficit and have reduced their growth forecast as well. So, I mean, Asia is going to be a very important part of the world economy for a long time to come. But the Asian century, does anybody believe that anymore?
Well, Rafael, what do you then think? Are there some serious sort of structural adjustments that China needs to make now then? Or should we just get used to, as John points out, those sort of slightly evasive, you know, economic minister statements reminds you of something you might hear in Westminster. Should we just get used to that? Or do you think there is a more pressing need for some more significant structural changes and to be made quickly?
Well, I think that the Chinese economy is one that has needed some sort of restructuring for quite some time. I think that, you know, and it's something that the Chinese government, I think, is trying to adapt to. But I think they're finding it very difficult to exert the levers of power to make things shift. Growing their domestic consumer economy is something that they've been talking about doing. They've sort of managed to do it. They sort of haven't. You've started to see labor costs going up in the country. I mean, I've spoken to people there who now say it's actually cheaper to go set up a factory in Laos, Cambodia, those sorts of countries, and they're migrating away. And if, you know, and China at the same time is trying to move up the sort of innovation ladder, but it's not totally clear that they've been able to. I mean, some of the new Huawei phones are quite nice, but do people really want to buy that over an Apple toy? I'm not so sure yet. So I think that there are a lot of things which the Chinese still need to fix. And fundamentally, when we look in the Asian markets and Asian economies, China is going to be the big determinant of it. And so how they actually come out and figure this out. The one caveat I would add to all of this is, you know, this is numbers today, and this accounts for, I think, the first quarter of this year. Let's wait and see what the second quarter looks like. I think we have to let these trends play out a little bit. I think sometimes, and I'm really not an economist, so I'm probably the last person who should say this, I wonder if we focus too much on specific sort of numbers when they emerge, and maybe in the longer term we'll look back and say, okay, as to the bigger point about this being the Asian century or not, I think that was always overplayed. You know, there was always this sense of when the dragon was rising in Asia, suddenly the world is going to be a transformed place. And yeah, there was always a bit of hubris involved there as well, which I think the Chinese and the other Asians, quite frankly, were happy to let sort of play out, you know.
Weren't they just, yes, the rising dragon. They loved it. They were lapping it up. And of course, it made great headlines all over. I agree with Rafael. I mean, it's one sort of point to remember is that the minimum wage in China now is four times the minimum wage in Bangladesh. Yeah. Nobody sets up a labour-intensive factory in China anymore. Those days are gone. Trends and spot figures, absolutely. I have to say, I mean, we use this article as a kind of focus for the discussion, but the long-term trend also looks pretty bad. And another angle to this that we haven't really got around to discussing is the fall in the Chinese currency. I mean, if you had told people a month ago that renminbi was going to be falling against the dollar, they'd have suggested you change your medication. But it's now been going on for day after day after day. Now, when this started, people were saying this was the Chinese central bank trying to send a signal that banking on renminbi was not a one-way bet. Now it's gone on that long. I think that explanation is looking very threadbare. I think we are seeing actually a bit of a tumble.
We could be. And I'm afraid we'll have to get into that next time. John Everard, former British ambassador to Pyongyang, and Rafaela Pantucci from RUSI. It's all we have time for. Thanks you both for joining us here on today's Midori House.
Thank you.
Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House. There's still plenty to come in the second half of today's programme. We'll review the latest exhibitions in Rio. We'll meet the co-founder of the Montreal Jazz Festival.
and we'll be on the line very soon with our man in Belgrade, Guy Delaunay. But before we get started on all of that, let's hear from Jonathan Wheatley, who has the latest world news headlines.
Tom, thanks very much. Interpol has confirmed that two passengers on the Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777, which went missing on Saturday, used stolen Austrian and Italian passports, raising suspicions of foul play. 239 people were on board that aircraft, which was flying from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, when it disappeared from radar screens. Accident investigators suspect the plane may have disintegrated in mid-flight. An estimated 50,000 ultra-Orthodox Jews held a mass prayer in New York's financial district to protest against a bill that would cut their Israeli community's military exemptions. The organisers, an alliance of different American Jews, called on people to attend the protest against new legislation ending the wholesale army exemptions granted to seminary students, which is expected to pass in the coming weeks. And lawyers for three college friends of the accused Boston Marathon bomber, who are charged with helping cover up evidence of the crime on Monday, asked for more records relating to their arrests. A large number of police swarmed the apartment south of Boston, shared by two of the men, both Kazakh exchange students, during a massive manhunt on the 19th of April for the bombing suspect Johar Tsarnaev. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. And Jonathan Wheatley will return once more at the top of the hour. He'll have a full bulletin of world news for you at 1900 hours London time. But you're listening to Midori House right now here on Monocle 24. It's 21:34 in Moscow, 18:34 in London, 16:34 in Rio de Janeiro, where we'll be heading a little later. But right now it's time to check in with one of our other correspondents around the world. A storm over some famous ashes and a classic game of political football. That's right, we're heading to Belgrade for a chat with our man there, Guy Delaunay. Guy, welcome to the programme. Great to speak to you, as always. Tell me about this ashes row, then. Nikola Tesla, I gather, the man at the heart of it.
Nikola Tesla, indeed. Now, I've had some people say to me, who is Nikola Tesla? And I think they've had their heads in the sand for a long time. just in case, for the uninitiated, he was one of the great scientists of the 19th and 20th centuries. You wouldn't be using alternating current if it weren't for Nikola Tesla. Electricity wirelessly, that was Nikola Tesla too. So all these things about inductive charging and all the rest of it that you get with your new iPhone, Nikola Tesla thought of that many decades ago. He's an enormous Serb hero because he was an ethnic Serb, though he lived here for about 5 minutes approximately, spent most of his life in the United States. His ashes lay here in a museum dedicated to him in the Vračar district of Belgrade, in a rather nice little villa, which has got all sorts of fun exhibits there, and you can get electric shocks and all sorts in there for a laugh if you want to go in one afternoon. But they may not lay there much longer, because the Orthodox Church, which is a powerful institution in Serbia, has said it wants to move the ashes from the museum to St. Sava's Cathedral, which is one of, if not the largest Orthodox Christian cathedrals in the world. And this hasn't gone down particularly well with everybody, it has to be said.
Why are people so unhappy then, Guy, if it's just about commemorating a great man in one place or another? Surely everyone can get on to the same page with that.
Well, he's a scientist, and scientists and religion don't get on particularly well a lot of the time. Tesla himself, his beliefs were best described as perhaps mystical rather than anything else. There is a film starring Nicolas Cage, which is extremely amusing. Goodness knows how real it is to the actual story of Nikola Tesla, but Nicolas Cage does a rather good scenery-chewing job as a mad scientist. It is worth watching. But suffice to say, there was not much blood of Christ drunk and body of Christ consumed during that film. And people point out he wasn't a religious man, and to put him in a cathedral, his ashes in a cathedral, would be against what he believed in, and more to the point, against what his family asked for. They specifically asked for his ashes to be repatriated from the United States to this museum, which is dedicated to him in Belgrade. And people quite reasonably say that, well, you haven't got his permission, you haven't got his family's permission, you shouldn't move him.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned Guy earlier, sort of what a legend he is in the country. I mean, it transcends other sort of political divides, does he? I mean, he's commemorated everywhere, not just in this museum.
Absolutely everywhere. In fact, throughout the former Yugoslavia, you will find Nikola Tesla boulevards. The airport in Belgrade is Nikola Tesla International. He's on the 100 dinar note here, which is the equivalent of a quid. You know, he's enormous. If you come to Belgrade, you'll see this man with a very smart, dapper centre-parted hairdo, a very cheeky moustache and a raised eyebrow. That's Nikola Tesla. He is everywhere. This is a country which struggles for national heroes. Let's be honest. If you say Serbia to people, a lot of folk will talk about Milosevic, Karadzic, so on and so forth. They need all the heroes they can get. And I think that has further promoted Nikola Tesla, who was already a significant Serb figure, even further, which is why you've got this row going on at the moment.
From one row guy to another, let's talk about Croatia and Serbia suing each other over genocide claims. A wrangle we've kind of touched upon before. Unpick the latest for us.
Yes, it's enormously silly, really. It's happening at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. Now, this is distinct from the Genocide Tribunal, which is covering crimes in the former Yugoslavia. This is the UN's International Court, which has been around since the end of the Second World War. Croatia originally sued Serbia for genocide back in 1999. Serbia countersued 4 years ago. It's finally hit court, despite, you know, cries to reason and all the rest of it. Croatia has already given its initial statements and initial witnesses last week. Serbia has been doing the same from today. It's all enormously dispiriting, but there we are.
And it seems slightly counterintuitive because relations between the countries are, you know, probably at a better mark than they've been for some time. How have we managed to run into this sort of bizarre hangover from the bad old days?
Yes, I think you could actually say legitimately, as Croatia's been independent for such a short number of years, relations are actually at an all-time high at the moment, post-Yugoslavia. They've exchanged ministerial and state visits. Croatia is supporting Serbia's bid to become the next member of the European Union, having become a member of the European Union itself last year. So it's all very mystifying. What seems to have happened here is nobody wanted to withdraw their suit first. So even though relations had improved, this case has gone ahead.
Now, Guy, I mentioned in your little intro that we talk a bit about political football. Tell me about this one. I'm a football fan, as you know. Kosovo have been playing a FIFA-approved international friendly. How did they get on, first of all?
Well, it was a bore draw. It was 0-0 against Haiti, who are ranked number 79 in the world. Not a bad side. A lot of players based in Europe, particularly playing in France. But it wasn't a thrilling match, it has to be said. Well, 0-0. It's a 0-0 thriller possible. I suppose it can be, but very infrequently. The thing is, as you say here, there's all sorts of caveats with this. A FIFA-approved international friendly. Well, that sort of indicates it wasn't really an official international friendly. FIFA said, OK, you can go ahead and do this. You can play against other members of FIFA, but not exactly under the auspices of FIFA. Are you following me?
Just about, Guy. Just in brief, I mean, we can all understand a bit of ill behaviour. I wonder, what was the reaction to the game? Was there any sort of, you know, mischief going on? Because we're used to seeing in this region, how should we call it, sort of football-related problems on and off down the years, aren't we?
No kidding. We had some with Croatia, actually, last week when they were playing in Switzerland and they got up to the old Nazi saluting again. In Kosovo, they restricted themselves to burning the flag of Serbia, which was a bit ungrateful, if you think about it, because they were playing the match because Serbia's Football Federation had made this deal with FIFA, which would allow Kosovo to play these friendlies. Now, in case anybody's forgotten, Serbia doesn't recognise the independence of Kosovo, and without that recognition, Kosovo can't get membership of FIFA, of the International Telephone Union, all sorts of other organisations. So it was really a deal that was made with Serbia that allowed it, but then the fans outside the stadium promptly burnt the Serb flag, and the match was held in Mitrovica, which is where the largest remaining ethnic Serb community in Kosovo is situated. So it was all a bit provocative, really.
Absolutely. Well, it could be the first and perhaps the last friendly for a while, at least happening there. Guy Delaunay, our man in Belgrade, thank you very much, as always, for joining us. Up next, we're meeting the director of the Montreal Jazz Festival, Andre Minau, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. Yes, this summer, the biggest jazz event in the world, the Festival International de Jazz de Montreal, turns 35. The event has hosted Miles Davis, Stevie Wonder and their like in the past. And this year, the festival honours Diana Ross, who will visit the jazz lovers in the city for the very first time. Andre Menau, the artistic director and co-founder of the festival, has been in London this week, so we invited him to Midori House for a chat. Fernando Augusto Pacheco asked him what we should be expecting this year, and also why Shirley Bassey isn't quite right for the festival.
what brings me to London. This is my favorite city to come to in the world right now. So I must come about 3 or 4 times a year now.
Are you doing some promotional events as well for the upcoming festival, which is actually celebrating 35 years?
Which makes me technically old. It's great because this is a festival that's put on by music fans for music fans prominently. So traveling, going to see concerts all the time, and then trying to bring this back to our city, it's always a very nice adventure every year. Now, I mean, we have to the tune of 600 different performances in 12 concert halls, 10 outdoor stages, all within 4 blocks of downtown Montreal. So it's very centralized. It's very pleasant because you can go from concert in a small concert hall and then you walk outside and there's this massive street party, all done very orderly, no problem, no hassle there. It's some kind of a utopian event in many ways.
Can you tell us about your involvement with the festival? I believe you were there since the beginning somehow.
Yeah. I'm the co-founder and artistic director since 1980. So I've seen lots of artists go by at the festival. Some have really taken off there. Diana Krall, for example, did a 10-night club engagement in 1994. And she still credits that moment for the time when things really took off for her, which is pretty flattering. Smoke, but I've lost my way. He knows that I am broke, but I must pay. Temptation. Michael Bublé, same thing, about 10 years later. 10 nights engagement, but in his case, we could not even finish the engagement in the club. We had to move him to the concert halls because he was doing so good at the time.
It is the biggest jazz festival in the world, correct?
Yeah, by the sheer numbers, for sure, because about 150 concerts are presented indoors, ticketed events, you know, and then outdoors is all free. Mm-hmm. So it generates an attendance of close to 2 million people every year, depending on the weather, obviously. Yeah. It is massive. It is very big. To be the biggest is nice, you know. As far as I'm concerned, we're mainly trying to be as relevant as can be. The biggest is by numbers, relevant is by the quality of the music that's presented. And this is what really matters to me.
But when I talk about this year's festival, and I've seen the lineup, wow, I'm impressed.
Well, this is the pre-lineup because the final lineup of the indoor concerts will be finalized by the end of this month. And then in early June, we tell the people what they're going to see for free. For the outdoor events, we have 4 main outdoor events and all of the other shows that are taking place every day. But the 4 main events, I can tell you that one will involve Woodkid on the opening night on the big stage. Whatever I feel for you, we only seem to care about you. This tiny chance you can see me too. I love you. This tiny thing I could do. And Diana Krall, great historical friend of the festival, will be doing a special 35th anniversary concert as well, a free concert on the street. Her last record, Glad Ragdoll, was kind of born in Montreal when she did 3 solo nights, trying out new things for her. She was playing the 78 RPMs of her father and then trying to play the songs on the stage. It was pretty conceptual. This is the end of that Glad Ragdoll operation. So we're going to go full circle with her from her humble beginnings at the festival to this massive concert and also from the start of this last project that she had. This is the closing night.
And can you tell us a little bit more about Diana Ross' presence at the festival this year?
Yeah, well, this is a big premiere for us. This is her jazz festival debut in Montreal. She's not played in our city for centuries now. I mean, well, not centuries, but last time she was there was in the 60s. So this goes way, way back. We're very flattered that she accepted our offer to come and perform for 2 nights in the 3,000-seater that we have on the jazz festival side called Salle Wilfrid Pelletier. Beautiful theater. And Michael Bublé is also doing 2 nights at the big hockey arena.
One of the interesting events that I was looking here is the For the Record Tarantino in concert.
Yes.
I want to see that. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Well, sometimes you take chances. I've only seen videos of this and I thought it was quite interesting. It's a company from Los Angeles who... they do that with some movie directors, you know, they try to recreate the music from the cult movies, and then they also have actors recreating some cult scenes from the cult movies. So that should be quite interesting. This one has the seal of approval of Quentin Tarantino. He went to see it 3 times and he loves it. So I was thinking, well, if Tarantino loves it, I think that his crowd will too. So we're doing this, I think, for 8 performances in a 500-seater. So nice, beautiful, intimate theater, but I think it's going to be total madness there.
And I have a curiosity as well, in terms of demographics, do you think jazz itself and even your festival is managing to attract a younger crowd?
Yes.
Because, I mean, you did mention Diana Krall, Michael Bublé. I do believe they kind of rejuvenated as well, jazz somehow. What do you think?
When we do things like Woodkid, obviously we do have a larger demographic than when you do strictly jazz, for sure. This year we have bands that are real on the progressive side of jazz. We've worked a lot with Kid Koala, Canadian guy. Kid Koala plays here all the time. He does the Sound Crash nights here. And so in order to get young people interested in improvised music, and I think that jazz has taken a lot of influences from everywhere, and it has influenced lots of music as well. We don't see jazz festival as a piece of museology. We try and be as contemporary as can be and try to take into account all the different musical styles that have touched jazz or that jazz has touched. And this is what makes it interesting. Obviously, sometimes it makes you do mistakes when you take chances, but I'd rather do some mistakes than keep repeating the same
program.
Can
you tell us one mistake?
Shirley Bassey did not belong. Okay. We did Shirley Bassey once, and it was pretty tacky. I would call it a mistake.
So what about one of the best years in the festival? Do you remember? Or every year is special for you?
Well, throughout the years, we've had many great events. But I mean, in the beginning, you still had the originals, you know. So we've worked a lot with Miles Davis 5 or 6 times, Ella Fitzgerald. This is totally unforgettable for me. And then at 30th anniversary, we had Stevie Wonder to inaugurate a new big public space that the city of Montreal built for the jazz festival called Place des Festivals. So Stevie Wonder for free on the street. I'll tell you, there was about 200,000 people there.
That was André Maynard speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco a little earlier. The Montreal Jazz Festival, of course, will take place between June 26th and July 6th later this year. Time, because I'm sure you're in a musical mood now, to move seamlessly from Montreal's jazzy vibes to the sounds of Brazil. In a minute, we'll review the new exhibitions in Rio de Janeiro, so let's get in the spirit with Seu Jorge and Mina do Condomínio.
Sei se ela me namora, e na maneira do condomínio, lá do bairro onde eu moro. Tô namorando aquela mina, mas não sei se ela me namora, e na maneira do condomínio, lá do bairro onde eu moro. Seu cabelo me alucina, sua boca me devora, sua voz me ilumina, seu olhar me apavora. Me perdi no seu sorriso, nem preciso me encontrar. Não me mostro paraíso, que se eu for não vou voltar. Pois eu vou, eu vou, eu vou, eu vou. Eu digo oi, ela nem nada passa na minha calçada. Dou bom dia, ela nem liga. Se ela chega eu paro tudo, se ela passa eu fico todo, e se vem vindo eu faço figa. Eu mando um beijo, ela não pega, pisco o olho, ela se nega, faço pose, ela não vê. Jogo charme, ela ignora, chego junto, ela sai fora, eu escrevo, ela não lê. Minha mina, minha amiga, minha namorada, minha sina do meu condomínio, minha musa, minha vida, minha Mona Lisa, minha Vênus, minha deusa, quero seu fascínio. Minha mina, minha amiga, minha namorada, minha gata, minha sina do meu condomínio, minha musa, minha vida, minha Mona Lisa, minha Vênus, minha deusa, quero seu fascínio.
That's the sound of Seu Jorge there. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we'll keep it a little bit Brazilian. because we're going to Rio next. It's time to do a review of the art scene in one international hub. That's where we're going. Our correspondent there, Sheena Rossiter, awaits. Sheena, very good day to you. Thanks for joining us, as always, on Midori House. Tell me, you're describing to us Rio's art museum. Tell us what's going on and why we need to know about it.
Yes, exactly. So right now, there's actually several really interesting exhibitions that are taking place at Rio's Art Museum, which is more commonly known actually by its acronym MOD. The museum is interesting itself because it's only actually been open for about a year, and it's been part of the city's facelift in the Old Port area, which is notoriously known as kind of a rundown no-go area for in the most recent decades. It's located in the neighborhood of Gamboa. It's an old part of Rio de Janeiro that's historically known to be one of the main slave trading hubs in the 18th and 19th century. So the museum itself is kind of a work of art in the sense that it's a modernist building that is kind of bridged over to the former residency of Dom João VI, who was part of the Portuguese imperial rule that came over at the time. So it kind of, it's the juxtaposed of the old meets the new. And then right now there's four exhibitions that are taking place in this museum. And the first one, which I checked out a few days ago, is called Imagina Rio, which in English would translate to Imagine Rio. And that's a really well-curated exhibition. It basically takes visitors through the history of the so-called marvelous city, taking us from paintings that document some of the Portuguese first arrivals here in the city in the 17th and 18th centuries. And then visitors kind of can like weave around the corner, and you can see all the landscape paintings that were a big trend in 19th century Europe. And of course, with Rio's naturally beautiful landscape, it was one of the main cities that was painted at the time. And then of course, it takes you all the way down to some of the most modern things that are come from Rio de Janeiro's city. One of them being an original sample mold of Christ the Redeemer's head and Di Cavalcanti's original paintings.
Sheena, it sounds incredibly complex, an incredibly rich amount of stuff on display. As you said, it must be very well curated to capture all of those different essences. What else is on? Because I know it's not just that. There's a Meeting of Worlds exhibition, I gather.
Exactly. So in total, there's six floors. That's on the top floor. When you step down a floor, there's another exhibition called The Meeting of Worlds, which also highlights a bit more of Brazilianism, if you will, which Brazilian culture was basically fused a meeting of worlds with the indigenous, the slave trade, and the Europeans coming over, as well as Japanese immigrants that came in the early 1900s. So this is a really interesting exhibition that kind of shows that fusion. It's not a particularly big one because it just takes up one room on half a floor in the museum itself, but definitely illustrates the old world meets the new world.
And what else? What about other flavors of maybe the rest of Brazil? Anything from the regions represented in the museum at the moment?
Yes, exactly. So there is another exhibition. It's called Pernambuco Experimental, which basically it shows the artists that have come out of the northeastern state from the 1920s up into the 1990s. Of course, the main character that's featured heavily in this exhibition is Gilberto Freire. He's a sociologist who wrote extensively about the racial mixture in Brazil in his book entitled Casa Grande e Senzala. Original copy of this book is on display in the exhibition, as well as political posters when he ran to be a federal deputy. Of course, in the end, he didn't win, but he still remains a very influential writer and thinker in Brazilian culture in general, coming from Pernambuco State. And a lot of the art that's featured in that exhibition itself, it comes from artists who did personally liaise and have conversations with Gilberto Freire himself.
Sheena, obviously a lot of people in Brazil this year of all years are talking about, well, people in Brazil are always talking about football, of course, but this year of all years because of the World Cup. But there's a bit of sort of culture and a bit of sport, I suppose, also explored in the museum that isn't about football. Some of the other sports. Tell us about this.
Yes, yeah, so the fourth and last exhibition, as you kind of work your way down through the museum, is Slide, Surf, and Skate. It's an art exhibition that looks specifically at surfing and skating. Of course, that's probably the most international of all the exhibitions that are happening right now at MAR, with skateboards that are painted by big names like Keith Haring and Andy Warhol. But of course, surfing and skating are two sports that remain very true and dear to Brazil. Brazilians' hearts. So that exhibition in particular is probably the most modern of the four that are taking place at the museum right now. It's mostly curated with photography, video installations, and paintings on surf and skateboards. And it brings a nice contrast from the first exhibitions, which kind of show more historical, old, typical Brazilian to, you know, the young, fresh exhibition, more youthful happening days that are happening now in Brazil. But in general, the museum is just really well curated from top to bottom. It takes you down. It does a good job of taking visitors from the old into the new modern Brazil, with more going from old type of classical art down to more modern art with the surf, the slide surf and skate exhibition at the end.
And it sounds very fitting, Sheena, because as you mentioned at the top, the museum itself is a meeting of old and new in so many ways, as are these exhibitions. It sounds like fascinating stuff. Thanks very much for painting such a vivid picture of what's happening at MAR in Rio for us. That's our correspondent in Rio, Sheena Rossiter. And that is all we have time for on today's episode of Midori House. My thanks in particular to my special guests, John Everard and Raffaello Pantucci, and to Sheena Rossiter too, of course. Today's show was expertly produced by Daphne Denis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Michaela Aitken, and our studio manager was Sean Malervi. Next up after the headlines, The Culture Show with Robert Bound, 2200 Hours, it's the Monocle Daily, with Andrew Miller and Dominic Reynolds in the chairs tonight. This show is back with me, Tom Edwards, at the very same time tomorrow. Until then, goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.